She had the information now. She had a map to find a murderer, and she would find him. But there was still the detective agency to run, and cases which needed to be dealt with, including a case which involved a very different sort of doctor, and a hospital. Mara Motswe had no stomach for hospitals. She disliked the smell of them. She shuddered at the sight of the patients sitting on benches in the sun, silenced by their suffering. Hospitals to her were a memento mori in bricks and mortar, an awful reminder of the inevitable end that was coming to all of us, but which she felt was best ignored while one got on with the business of life. Doctors were another matter altogether, and Mara Motswe had always been impressed by them. She admired in particular their sense of the confidential, and she took comfort in the fact that you could tell a doctor something, and, like a priest, he would carry your secret to the grave. Which was as it should be, thought Mara Motswe. I should not like anybody else to know about my... What had she to be embarrassed about? She thought hard. Her weight was hardly a confidential matter, and anyway, she was proud of being a traditionally built African lady, unlike these terrible stick-like creatures one saw in the advertisements. Then there were her corns. Well, those were more or less on public display when she wore her sandals. Really, there was nothing that she felt she had to hide. Now, constipation was quite a different matter. It would be dreadful for the whole world to know about troubles of that nature. She felt terribly sorry for people who suffered from constipation, and she knew that there were many who did. There were probably enough of them to form a political party, with a chance of government, perhaps. But what would such a party do if it was in power? Nothing, she imagined. It would try to pass legislation, but would fail. She stopped her reverie and turned to the business in hand. Her old friend Dr. Mckechi had telephoned and asked if he could call in at her office on his way home that evening. She readily agreed. She and Dr. Mckechi were both from Machudi, and although he was 10 years her senior, she felt extremely close to him. So she cancelled her hair-braiding appointment in town and stayed at her desk until Dr. Mckechi's familiar voice called out, "Ho, ho!" and he came into the office. They exchanged family gossip for a while, drinking bush tea, and she asked after Dr. Mckechi's aunt, a retired teacher to whom half the village still turned for advice. She had not run out of steam, he said, and was now being pressed to stand for Parliament, which she might yet do. "We need more women in public life," said Dr. Mckechi. "They are very practical people, women, unlike us men." Mara Motswe was quick to agree. "If more women were in power, they wouldn't let wars break out," she said. "Women can't be bothered with all this fighting. We see war for what it is, a matter of broken bodies and crying mothers." Dr. Mckechi thought of Mrs. Gandhi, who had a war, and Mrs. Golda Meir, who also had a war, and then there was... "Most of the time," he conceded, "women are gentle most of the time, but they can be tough when they need to be." Dr. Mckechi was eager to change the subject now, as he feared that Mara Motswe might go on to ask him whether he could cook, and he did not want a repetition of the conversation he had had with a young woman who had returned from a year in the United States. She had said to him, challengingly, as if the difference in their ages were of no consequence, "If you eat, you should cook. It's as simple as that." These ideas came from America, and may be all very well in theory, but had they made the Americans any happier? Surely there had to be some limits to all this progress. He had heard recently of men who were obliged by their wives to change the nappies of their babies. He shuddered at the thought. Africa was not ready for that, he reflected. There were some aspects of the old arrangements in Africa which were very appropriate and comfortable, if you were a man, which of course Dr. Mckechi was. "But these are big issues," he said jovially. "Talking about pumpkins doesn't make them grow." His mother-in-law said this frequently, and although he disagreed with almost everything she said, he found himself echoing her words only too often. Mara Motswe laughed. "Why have you come to see me?" she said. "Do you want me to find you a new wife, maybe?" Dr. Mckechi clicked his tongue in mock disapproval. "I have come about a real problem," he said, "not just about a little question of wives." Mara Motswe listened as the doctor explained just how delicate his problem was. "Not even my secretary will get to hear what you tell me," she said. "Good," said Dr. Maketsi, "because if I am wrong about this, and if anybody hears about it, I shall be very seriously embarrassed, as will the whole hospital. I don't want the minister coming looking for me." "I understand," said Mara Motswe. Her curiosity was thoroughly aroused now. She had been burdened with several rather mundane cases recently, including a very demeaning one which involved tracing a rich man's dog. A dog? The only lady detective in the country should not have to stoop to such depths, and indeed Mara Motswe would not have done so had it not been for the fact that she needed the fee. And what a terrible, malodorous dog it had turned out to be. When she eventually found the animal, being dragged along on a string by the group of urchins which had stolen it, the dog had rewarded its liberator with a bite on the ankle. "I am worried about one of our young doctors," said Dr. Maketsi. "He is called Dr. Komoti. He's Nigerian."
"I see."
"I know that some people are suspicious of Nigerians," said Dr. Maketsi.
"I believe that there are some people like that," said Mara Motswe, catching the doctor's eye and then looking away again quickly, almost guiltily. "Let me tell you about our Dr. Komoti," he said. "Starting from the time he first turned up for interview, it was my job to interview him, although I must admit that it was rather a formality. We were desperately short of people and needed somebody who would be able to lend a hand in casualty. We can't really be too choosy, you know. Anyway, he seemed to have a reasonable CV, and he had brought several references with him. He had been working in Nairobi for a few years, and so I telephoned the hospital he was at, and they confirmed that he was perfectly all right. So I took him on. He started about 6 months ago. He was pretty busy in casualty. You probably know what it's like in there. Road accidents, fights, the usual Friday evening business. Of course, a lot of the work is just cleaning up, stopping the bleeding, the occasional resuscitation, that sort of thing. Everything seemed to be going well. But after Dr. Komoti had been there about 3 weeks, the consultant in charge had a word with me. He said that he thought that the new doctor was a bit rusty and that some of the things he did seemed a bit surprising. For example, he had sewed several wounds up quite badly, and the stitching had to be redone. But sometimes he was really quite good. For example, a couple of weeks ago we had a woman coming in with a tension pneumothorax. That's a pretty serious matter. Air gets into the space round the lungs and makes the lung collapse like a popped balloon. If this happens, you have to drain the air out as quickly as you can so that the lung can expand again. This is a tricky job for an inexperienced doctor. You've got to know where to put in the drain. If you get it wrong, you could even puncture the heart or do all sorts of other damage. If you don't do it quickly, the patient can die. I almost lost somebody myself with one of these a few years ago. I got quite a fright over it. Dr. Komoti turned out to be pretty good at this, and he undoubtedly saved this woman's life. The consultant was impressed and mentioned it to me. But at the same time, this is the same doctor who had failed to spot an obvious case of enlarged spleen the day before.
He's inconsistent, said Mara Motswe.
Exactly, said Dr. Maketsi. One day he'll be fine, but the next day he'll come close to killing some unfortunate patient.
Mara Motswe thought for a moment, remembering a news item in the Star.
I was reading the other day about a bogus surgeon in Johannesburg, she said. He practiced for almost 10 years, and nobody knew that he had no qualifications. Then somebody spotted something by chance, and they exposed him. Did you check up on his qualifications? It's easy enough to forge documents these days with photocopiers and laser printers. Anybody can do it. Maybe he's not a doctor at all. He could have been a hospital porter or something like that.
Dr. Maketsi shook his head.
We went through all that, he said. We checked with his medical school in Nigeria. That was a battle, I can tell you. We also checked with the General Medical Council in Britain, where he did a registrar's job for 2 years. We even obtained a photograph from Nairobi, and it's the same man. So I'm pretty sure that he's exactly who he says he is.
Couldn't you try to find out how much he knows about medicine by just asking him some tricky questions?
Dr. McKenzie smiled. I've done that already. I've taken the opportunity to speak to him about one or two difficult cases. On the first occasion, he coped quite well, and he gave a fairly good answer. He clearly knew what he was talking about. But on the second occasion, he said that he wanted to think about it. This annoyed me, and so I mentioned something about the case we had discussed before. This took him off his guard, and he mumbled something inconsequential. It was as if he had forgotten what he'd said to me 3 days before.
Mara Motswe looked up at the ceiling. She knew about forgetfulness. Her poor daddy had become forgetful at the end and had sometimes barely remembered her. That was understandable in the old, but not in a young doctor. Unless he was ill, of course, and in that case something could have gone wrong with his memory.
There's nothing wrong with him mentally, said Dr. McKenzie, as if predicting her question. As far as I can tell, that is. This isn't a case of presenile dementia or anything like that. What I'm afraid of is drugs. I think that he's possibly abusing drugs.
Dr. McKenzie paused. He had delivered his bombshell, and he sat back, as if silenced by the implications of what he had said. This was almost as bad as if they had been allowing an unqualified doctor to practice. If the minister heard that a doctor was treating patients in the hospital while high on drugs, he might begin to question the closeness of supervision in the hospital. He imagined the interview.
Now, Dr. McKenzie, could you not see from the way this man was behaving that he was drugged? Surely you people should be able to spot things like that. If it's obvious enough to me when I walk down the street that somebody has been smoking dagger, then surely it should be obvious enough to somebody like you. Or am I fondly imagining that you people are more perceptive than you really are?
I can see why you're worried, said Mara Motswe. But I'm not sure whether I can help. I don't really know my way around the drug scene. That's really a police matter.
Dr. McKenzie was dismissive. Don't talk to me about the police, he said. If I went to them to get this looked into, they'd treat it as a straightforward drugs inquiry. They'd barge in and search his house, and then somebody would talk about it. In no time at all, word would be all about town that he was a drug addict.
He paused, concerned that Mara Motswe should understand the subtleties of his dilemma.
And what if I'm wrong? Then I would have as good as killed his reputation for no reason. He may be incompetent from time to time, but that's no reason for destroying him.
But if we did find out that he was using drugs, said Mara Motswe, and I'm not sure how we could do this, what then? Would you dismiss him?
Dr. McKenzie shook his head vigorously. We don't think about drugs in those terms. It isn't a question of good behavior and bad behavior. I'd look on it as a medical problem, and I'd try to help him. I'd try to sort out the problem.
But you can't sort out with those people, said Mara Motswe. Smoking dagger is one thing, but using pills and all the rest is another. Show me one reformed drug addict, just one. Maybe they exist. I've just never seen them.
Dr. McKenzie shrugged. I know they can be very manipulative people, he said, but some of them get off it. I can show you some figures.
Well, maybe not, said Mara Motswe. The point is, what do you want me to do?
Find out about him, said Dr. McKenzie. Follow him for a few days. Find out whether he's involved in the drug scene. If he is, find out whether he's supplying others with drugs while you're about it. Because that will be another problem for us. We keep a tight rein on drugs in the hospital, but things can go missing. And the last thing we want is a doctor who's passing hospital drug supplies to addicts. We can't have that.
You'd sack him then? Goaded Mara Motswe.
Dr. McKenzie laughed. We'd sack him good and proper.
Good, said Mara Motswe. And proper too. Now, I have to tell you about my fee.
Dr. McKenzie's face fell. I was worried about that. This is such a delicate inquiry. I could hardly get the hospital to pay for it.
Mara Motswe nodded knowingly. You thought that as an old friend...
Yes, said Dr. McKenzie quietly.
I thought that as an old friend you might remember how when your daddy was so ill at the end...
Mara Motswe did remember.
Dr. McKenzie had come unfailingly to the house every evening for 3 weeks, and eventually had arranged for her daddy to be put in a private room at the hospital, all for nothing.
I remember very well, she said. I only mentioned the fee to tell you that there would be none.
She had all the information she needed to start her investigation of Dr. Komotsi. She had his address in Kaunda Way, she had a photograph supplied by Dr. McKenzie, and she had a note of the number of the green station wagon which he drove. She had also been given his telephone number and the number of his postal box at the post office, although she could not imagine the circumstances in which she might need these. Now all she had to do was to start to watch Dr. Komotsi and to learn as much as she could about him in the shortest possible time. Dr. McKenzie had thoughtfully provided her with a copy of the duty rota in the casualty department for the following 4 months. This meant that Mara Motswe would know exactly when he might be expected to leave the hospital to return home, and also when he might be on night duty. This would save a great deal of time and effort in sitting waiting in the street in the tiny white van. She started 2 days later. She was there when Dr. Komotsi drove out of the staff car park at the hospital that afternoon, and she followed him discreetly into town, parking a few cars away from him and waiting until he was well away from the car park before she got out of the van. He visited one or two shops and picked up a newspaper from the book centre. Then he returned to his car, drove straight home, and stayed there, blamelessly, she assumed, until the lights went out in the house, just before 10 that evening. It was a dull business, sitting in the tiny white van, but Mara Motswe was used to it, and never complained once she had agreed to take on a matter. She would sit in her van for a whole month, even more, if asked to do so by Dr. McKenzie. It was the least she could do, after what he had done for her daddy. Nothing happened that evening, nor the next evening. Mara Motswe was beginning to wonder whether there was ever any variety to the routine of Dr. Komoti's life, when on a Friday afternoon, Dr. Komotsi came out of the casualty entrance and climbed into his car and, instead of turning into town, he turned the other way and headed for the Lobatse Road. This was interesting. If he was dealing in drugs, then to use Lobatse as a base would be a good idea because it was close to the border. Mara Motswe was not worried about being spotted. The road was busy and there was no reason why Dr. Komotsi should single out the tiny white van. Once they got to Lobatse, of course, she would have to be more circumspect, as he could notice her in the thinner traffic there. When they did not stop in Lobatse, Mara Motswe began to worry. There was not much on the other side of Lobatse, or not much to interest somebody like Dr. Komotsi. The only other thing, then, was the border, some miles down the road. Yes, Dr. Komotsi was going over the border. She was sure of it. He was going to Mafeking. As the realization dawned, Mara Motswe felt an intense irritation with her own stupidity. She did not have her passport with her. Dr. Komotsi would go through, and she would have to remain in Botswana. And once he was on the other side, then he could do whatever he liked, and no doubt would, and she would know nothing about it. She watched him stop at the border post, and then she turned back. He would be away for the weekend now, and next week she would have to get back to the tedious task of watching his house by night, in the frustrating knowledge that the real mischief had taken place over the weekend. And while she was doing all this, she would have to postpone other cases, cases which carried fees and paid bills. When she arrived back in Habrone, Mara Motswe was in a thoroughly bad mood. She had an early night, but the bad mood was still with her the following morning when she went into the mall. As she often did on a Saturday morning, she had a cup of coffee on the veranda of the President Hotel and enjoyed a chat with her friend Grace Gakatsla. Grace, who had a dress shop in Broadhurst, always cheered her up with her stories of the vagaries of her customers. One, a government minister's wife, had recently bought a dress on a Friday and brought it back the following Monday, saying that it did not really fit. Yet Grace had been at the wedding on Saturday where the dress had been worn, and it had looked perfect. Of course I couldn't tell her to her face she was a liar, and that I wasn't a dress hire shop, said Grace. So I asked her if she had enjoyed the wedding. She smiled and said that she had. So I said I enjoyed it too. She obviously hadn't seen me there. She stopped smiling, and she said that maybe she'd give the dress another chance. She's just a porcupine, that woman, said Mara Motswe. A hyena, said Grace. An anteater with a long nose. The laughter had died away, and Grace had gone off, allowing Mara Motswe's bad mood to settle back in place. Mara Motswe paid her bill and left. And it was then, as she was walking down the front steps of the hotel, that she saw Dr. Komote in the mall. For a moment, Mara Motswe stood quite still. Dr. Komote had crossed the border last night just before 7 in the evening. The border closed at 8, which meant that he could not possibly have had time to get down to Mafeking, which was a further 40 minutes' drive, and back in time to cross again before the border closed. So he had only spent one evening there and had come back first thing that morning. Mara Motswe recovered from her surprise at seeing Dr. Komote and realized that she should make good use of the opportunity to follow him and see what he did. He walked back to the car park and she watched him getting into his car. Dr. Komote stayed in for the rest of the day. At 6 in the evening, he went off to the Sun Hotel, where he had a drink with two other men, whom Mara Motswe recognized as fellow Nigerians. One of them worked for a firm of accountants, and the other, she believed, was a primary school teacher. There was nothing about their meeting which seemed suspicious. He stayed an hour and then left, and that was the extent of Dr. Komote's social life for the weekend. By Sunday evening, Mara Motswe had decided that she would report to Dr. Maketsi the following week and tell him that there was unfortunately no evidence of Dr. Komote moving in drug-abusing circles, that he seemed to be the model of sobriety and respectability. There was not even a sign of women, unless they were hiding in the house and never came out. Nobody had arrived at the house while she was watching, and nobody had left, apart from Dr. Komote himself. He was, quite simply, rather a boring man to watch. But there was still the question of Mafeking, and the Friday evening dash there and back. If he had been going shopping down there in the OK bazaars, as many people did, then he would surely have stayed for at least part of Saturday morning. He must have done, then, whatever it was he wanted to do on Friday evening. Was there a woman down there, one of those flashy South African women whom men so unaccountably seem to like? That would be the simple explanation. But why the hurry back on Saturday morning? Why not stay for Saturday and take her to lunch at the Mbabato Hotel? There was something which did not seem quite right, and Mara Motswe thought that she might follow him down to Mafeking next weekend and see what happened. If there was nothing to be seen, then she could do some shopping and return on Saturday afternoon. Dr. Komote proved obliging. The following Friday, he left the hospital on time and drove off in the direction of Lobatse, followed at a distance by Mara Motswe in her van. Crossing the border proved tricky, as Mara Motswe had to make sure that she did not get too close to him at the border post, and that at the same time she did not lose him on the other side. For a few moments it looked as if she would be delayed, as a ponderous official paged closely through her passport, looking at the stamps which reflected her coming and going to Johannesburg and Mafeking.
"It says here, under occupation, that you are a detective," he said in a surly tone. "How can a woman be a detective?"
Mara Motswe glared at him. If she prolonged the encounter, she would lose Dr. Komote, whose passport was now being stamped. In a few minutes he would be through the border controls, and the tiny white van would have no chance of catching up with him. "Many women are detectives," said Mara Motswe with dignity. "Have you not read Agatha Christie?" The clerk bristled.
"Are you saying I'm not an educated man?" he growled. "That I have not read this Mr. Christie?"
"I am not," said Mara Motswe,
You people are well educated and efficient. Only yesterday, when I was in your minister's house, I said to him that I thought his immigration people were very polite and efficient. We had a good talk about it over supper. The official froze. Then he reached for his rubber stamp and stamped the passport.
Thank you, Ma, he said. You may go now.
Ma Ramotswe did not like lying, but sometimes it was necessary, particularly when faced with people who were promoted beyond their talents. An embroidering of the truth like that. She knew the minister, even if only very distantly, sometimes gingered people up a bit, and it was often for their own good. Perhaps that particular official would think twice before he again decided to bully a woman for no good reason. She climbed back into the van and was waved past the barrier. There was now no sight of Dr. Komoti, and she had to push the van to its utmost before she caught up with him. He was not going particularly fast, and so she dropped back slightly and followed him past the remnants of Mangope's capital and its fantoche Republic of Boputatswana. There was the stadium in which the president had been held by his own troops when they revolted. There were the government offices that administered the absurdly fragmented state on behalf of its masters in Pretoria. It was all such a waste, she thought. Such an utter folly. And when the time had come, it had just faded away like the illusion that it had always been. It was all part of the farce of apartheid and the monstrous dream of Verwoerd. Such pain, such long drawn out suffering, to be added by history to all the pain of Africa. Dr. Komoti suddenly turned right. They had reached the outskirts of Mafeking, in a suburb of neat, well-laid-out streets and houses with large, well-fenced gardens. It was into the driveway of one of these houses that he turned, requiring Ma Ramotswe to drive past to avoid causing suspicion. She counted the number of houses she passed, 7, and then parked the van under a tree. There was what used to be called a sanitary lane which ran down the back of the houses. Ma Ramotswe stood in the sanitary lane at the back of the 8th house and peered through the garden. It was a tangle of vegetation, mulberry trees, uncontrolled bougainvillea bushes that had grown to giant proportions and sent great sprigs of purple flowers skywards, pawpaw trees with rotting fruit on the stem. It would be a paradise for snakes, she thought. There could be mambas lurking in the uncut grass and boomslangs draped over the branches of the trees, lying in wait for somebody like her to be foolish enough to enter. She pushed the gate open gingerly. It was virtually impossible to see the house through the greenery, which made Ma Ramotswe feel safe from the eyes of those within the house at least, if not from snakes. Ma Ramotswe moved forward gingerly, placing each foot carefully, but nothing moved, and she was soon crouching under a mulberry tree as close as she dared to get to the house. From the shade of the tree she had a good view of the back door and the open kitchen window, yet she could not see into the house itself, as it was of the old colonial style with wide eaves, which made the interior cool and dark. It was far easier to spy on people who live in modern houses, because architects today had forgotten about the sun and put people in goldfish bowls where the whole world could peer in through large unprotected windows, should they so desire. Now, what should she do? Suddenly, a window at the back of the house opened and a man leaned out. It was Dr. Komoti.
You over there. Yes, you, fat lady, what are you doing sitting under a mulberry tree?
Ma Ramotswe experienced a sudden, absurd urge to look over her shoulder, as if to imply that there was somebody else under the tree. She felt like a schoolgirl caught stealing fruit, or doing some other forbidden act. There was nothing one could say. One just had to own up. She stood up and stepped out from the shade.
It is hot, she called out. Can you give me a drink of water?
A moment or two later, the kitchen door opened. Dr. Komoti stood on the step, wearing quite different clothes from those he had on when he left Habrone. He had a mug of water in his hand, which he gave to her. Ma Ramotswe reached out and drank the water gratefully.
What are you doing in our garden? Said Dr. Komoti,
not unkindly.
Are you a thief?
Ma Ramotswe looked pained. I am not, she said. Somebody appeared behind Dr. Komoti and looked out over his shoulder. It was Dr. Komoti.
What's going on? Said the second Dr. Komoti. What does this woman want? I saw her in the garden, said the first Dr. Komoti. She tells me she isn't a thief.
And I certainly am not, she said indignantly. I was looking at this house. I used to live here when I was a little girl. There were boys living in it then, a Mr. Van der Heever and his wife. My mother was their cook, and we lived in the servants' quarters, back there at the end of the garden. My father kept the garden tidy.
She broke off and looked at the two men in reproach.
It was better in those days, she said. The garden was well looked after.
Oh, I'm sure it was, said one of the two. We'd like to get it under control one day. It's just that we're busy men. We're both doctors, you see.
Ah, said Ma Ramotswe, trying to sound reverential. You are doctors here at the hospital.
No, said the first Dr. Komoti. I have a surgery down near the railway station.
My brother,
I walk up that way,
said the other Dr. Komoti, pointing vaguely to the north.
Anyway, you can look at the garden as much as you like, mother. You just go ahead. We can make you a mug of tea.
Aye, said Ma Ramotswe. You are very kind. Thank you.
For a few minutes, Ma Ramotswe pretended to inspect the trees and the shrubs, or what could be seen of them, and then, thanking her hosts for the tea, she walked off down the road, her mind busily turned over the curious information she had obtained. There were two Dr. Komotis, which was nothing terribly unusual in itself, yet somehow she felt that this was the essence of the whole matter. Twins often led mirrored lives, and sometimes even went so far as to marry the sister of the other's wife. But there was something particularly significant here, and Ma Ramotswe was sure that it was staring her in the face, if only she could begin to see it. She got into the tiny white van and drove back down the road towards the centre of town. One Dr. Komoti had said that he had a surgery in town, near the railway station, and she decided to take a look at this. She knew the railway station slightly. It was a place that she enjoyed visiting, as it reminded her of the old Africa, the days of uncomfortable companionship on crowded trains, of slow journeys across great plains, of the sugarcane you used to eat to while away the time, and of the pith of the cane you used to spit out of the wide windows. Here you could still see it, or a part of it. Here, where the trains that came up from the Cape pulled slowly past the platform on their journey up through Botswana to Bulawayo here. Where the Indian stores beside the railway building still sold cheap blankets and men's hats with a garish feather tucked into the band. Ma Ramotswe did not want Africa to change. She did not want her people to become like everybody else, soulless, selfish, forgetful of what it means to be an African, or worse still, ashamed of Africa. She would not be anything but an African, never, even if somebody came up to her and said, "Here's a pill, the very latest thing. Take it, and it will make you into an American." She would say no, never, no thank you. She stopped the white van outside the railway station and got out. There were a lot of people about, women selling roasted maize cobs and sweet drinks, men talking loudly to their friends, a family travelling with cardboard suitcases and possessions bundled up in a blanket. Ma Ramotswe approached one of the women traders and spoke to her in Setswana. "Are you well today, Ma?" she said politely.
"I am well, and you are well too, Ma?"
"I am well, and I have slept very well."
"Good."
The greeting over, she said,
"People tell me that there is a doctor here who is very good. They call him Dr. Komoti. Do you know where his place is?"
The woman nodded.
"There are many people who go to that doctor. His place is over there. Do you see where that white man has just parked his truck? That's where he is."
Ma Ramotswe thanked her informant and bought a cob of roasted maize. Then she walked across the dusty square to the rather dilapidated tin-roofed building where Dr. Komoti's surgery was to be found. Rather to her surprise, the door was not locked. And when she pushed it open, she found a woman standing directly in front of her.
"I am sorry, the doctor isn't here, Ma," said the woman, slightly testily. "I am the nurse. You can see the doctor on Monday afternoon."
"Ah," said Ma Ramotswe. "It is a sad thing to have to tidy up on a Friday evening when everybody else is thinking of going out."
The nurse shrugged her shoulders.
"I like to get everything ready for Monday before the weekend starts. It's better that way."
"Far better," Ma Ramotswe answered, thinking quickly. "I didn't actually want to see the doctor
Oh, not as a patient. I used to work for him, you see, when he was up in Nairobi. I was a nurse on his ward. I wanted just to say hello. The nurse's manner became markedly more friendly.
I'll make you some tea, Ma, she offered. It's still quite hot outside.
Mara Motswe sat down and waited for the nurse to return with a pot of tea.
Do you know the other Dr. Komoti? She said. The brother.
Oh, yes, said the nurse. We see a lot of him. He comes in here to help, you see, 2 or 3 times a week.
Mara Motswe lowered her cup very slowly. She realized that she was at the heart of the matter now, the elusive solution within her grasp. But she would have to sound casual.
Oh, they did that up in Nairobi too, she said, waving her hand as if these things were of little consequence. One helped the other, and usually the patients didn't know that they were seeing a different doctor.
The nurse laughed.
They do it here too, she said. I'm not sure if it's quite fair on the patients, but nobody has realized that there are 2 of them, so everybody seems quite satisfied.
Mara Motswe picked up her cup again and passed it for refilling.
And what about you? She said. Can you tell them apart?
The nurse handed the teacup back to Mara Motswe.
I can tell by one thing, she said. One of them is quite good. The other's hopeless. The hopeless one knows hardly anything about medicine. If you ask me, it's a miracle that he got through medical school.
Mara Motswe thought, but did not say. He didn't. She stayed in Mafeking that night, at the station hotel, which was noisy and uncomfortable, but she slept well nonetheless, as she always did when she had just finished an inquiry. The next morning she shopped at the OK Bazaars and found, to her delight, that there was a rail of size 22 dresses on special offer. She bought 3, 2 more than she really needed, but if you were the owner of the number one ladies' detective agency, you had to keep up a certain style. She was home by 3 o'clock that afternoon, and she telephoned Dr. McKenzie at his house and invited him to come immediately to her office to be informed of the results of her inquiry. He arrived within 10 minutes and sat opposite her in the office, fiddling anxiously with the cuffs of his shirt. First of all, announced Mara Motswe, no drugs. Dr. McKenzie breathed a sigh of relief.
Thank goodness for that. That's one thing I was really worried about.
Well, said Mara Motswe doubtfully, I'm not sure if you're going to like what I'm going to tell you.
He's not qualified, gasped Dr. McKenzie. Is that it? One of them is qualified, said Mara Motswe. Dr. McKenzie looked blank.
One of them?
Mara Motswe settled back in her chair.
There were once 2 twins, she began. One went to medical school and became a doctor. The other did not. The one with the qualification got a job as a doctor, but was greedy and thought that 2 jobs as a doctor would pay better than 1. So he took 2 jobs and did both of them part-time. When he wasn't there, his brother, who was his identical twin, you'll recall, did the job for him. He used such medical knowledge as he had picked up from his qualified brother, and no doubt also got advice from the brother as to what to do. And that's it. That's the story of Dr. Komoti and his twin brother in Mafeking. Dr. McKenzie sat absolutely silent.
So, we've had both of them in the hospital, he said at last. Sometimes we've had the qualified one, and sometimes we've had the twin brother. 2 jobs for the price of 1 medical degree. It's the most cunning scheme I've come across for a long, long time.
I have to admit, I was amazed by it, said Mara Motswe. I thought that I'd seen all the varieties of human dishonesty, but obviously one can still be surprised from time to time.
Dr. McKenzie rubbed his chin.
I'll have to go to the police about this, he said. There's going to have to be a prosecution. We have to protect the public from people like this.
Unless, started Mara Motswe. Dr. McKenzie grabbed at the straw he suspected she might be offering him.
Can you think of an alternative? He asked. Once this gets out, people will take fright. we'll have people encouraging others not to go to hospital. Our public health programs rely on trust. You know how it is.
Precisely, said Mara Motswe. I suggest that we transfer the heat elsewhere.
I agree with you. Dr. Komoti is going to have to be struck off, or whatever you people do. But why not get this done in somebody else's patch?
Do you mean in Mafeking?
Yes, said Mara Motswe. After all, an offence is being committed down there, and we can let the South Africans deal with it. The papers up here in Habrone probably won't even pick up on it. All that people here will know is that Dr. Komoti resigned suddenly, which people often do, for all sorts of reasons. With your permission, I shall telephone my friend Billy Pilani, who's a police captain down there. He'd love to be seen to expose a bogus doctor. Billy likes a good, sensational arrest.
You do that, said Dr. Maketsi, smiling.
This was a tidy solution to a most extraordinary matter, and he was most impressed with the way in which Mara Motswe had handled it.
You know, he said,
I don't think that even my aunt in Mochudi could have dealt with this any better than you have.
Mara Motswe smiled at her old friend. You can go through life and make new friends every year, every month practically, but there was never any substitute for those friendships of childhood that survive into adult years. Those are the ones in which we are bound to one another with hoops of steel. She reached out and touched Dr. Maketsi on the arm, gently, as old friends will sometimes do when they have nothing more to say. A dusty track hardly in use, enough to break the springs. A hill, a tumble of boulders, just as the sketch map drawn by Mr. Charlie Hotso had predicted. And above, stretching from horizon to horizon, the empty sky, singing in the heat of noon. Mara Motswe steered the tiny white van cautiously, avoiding the rocks that could tear the sump from the car. This was dead country. No cattle, no goats. Only the bush and the stunted thorn trees. That anybody should want to live here, away from a village, away from human contact, seemed inexplicable. Suddenly she saw the house, tucked away behind the trees, almost in the shadow of the hill. It was a bare earth house in the traditional style, brown mud walls, a few glassless windows, with a knee-height wall around the yard. A previous owner, a long time ago, had painted designs on the wall, but neglect and the years had scaled them off and only their ghosts remained. She parked the van and drew in her breath. She had faced down fraudsters. She had coped with jealous wives. She had even stood up to Mr. Hotso. But this meeting would be different. This was evil incarnate, the heart of darkness, the root of shame. This man, for all his mumbo-jumbo and his spells, was a murderer. She opened the door and eased herself out of the van. The sun was riding high and its light prickled at her skin. They were too far west here, too close to the Kalahari, and her unease increased. This was not the comforting land she had grown up with. This was the merciless Africa, the waterless land. She made her way towards the house, and as she did so, she felt that she was being watched. At the wall, in accordance with custom, she stopped and called out, announcing herself.
"I am very hot," she said. "I need water."
There was no reply from within the house, but a rustle to her left, amongst the bushes. She turned round, almost guiltily, and stared. It was a large black beetle, a Seto Tojani, with its horny neck, pushing at a minute trophy, some insect that had died of thirst, perhaps. Little disasters, little victories. Like ours, she thought. When viewed from above, we are no more than Seto Tojani.
Ma?
She turned round sharply. A woman was standing in the doorway wiping her hands on a cloth. Mara Motswe stepped through the gateless break in the wall.
Dumela ma,
she said.
I am Mara Motswe.
The woman nodded.
I am Ma Nochi.
Mara Motswe studied her. She was a woman in her late 50s, or thereabouts, wearing a long skirt of the sort which the Herero women wore, but she was not Herero.
I have come to see your husband, she said. I have to ask him for something.
The woman came out from the shadows and stood before Mara Motswe, peering at her face in a disconcerting way.
You have come for something? You want to buy something from him?
Mara Motswe nodded. I have heard that he is a very good doctor. I have trouble with another woman. She's taking my husband from me, and I want something that will stop her.
The older woman smiled.
He can help you, but he is in Nobatse until Saturday. You will have to come back sometime after that.
Mara Motswe sighed. This has been a long trip, and I am thirsty. Do you have any water, my sister?
Yes, I have water. You can come and sit in the house while you drink it.
It was a small room, furnished with a rickety table and two chairs. There was a grain bin in the corner, of the traditional sort, and a battered tin trunk. Mara Motswe sat on one of the chairs while the woman fetched a white enamel mug of water, which she gave to her visitor. The water was slightly rancid, but Mara Motswe drank it gratefully. Then she put the mug down and looked at the woman.
I have come for something, as you know, but I have also come to warn you of something.
To warn me?
Yes, said Mara Motswe. I am a typist. Do you know what that is?
The woman nodded.
I work for the police, went on Mara Motswe, and I have typed out something about your husband. They know that he killed that boy, the one from Katsana. They know that he is the man who took him and killed him for Muti. They are going to arrest your husband soon, and then they will hang him. I came to warn you that they will hang you also, because they say that you are involved in it too. They say that you did it too. I do not think they should hang women, so I came to tell you that you could stop all this quickly if you came with me to the police and told them what happened. They will believe you, and you will be saved. Otherwise, you will die very soon. Next month, I think.
She stopped. The other woman had dropped the cloth she had been carrying and was staring at her, wide-eyed. Mara Motswe knew the odor of fear, that sharp, acrid smell that people emit through the pores of their skin when they are frightened. Now the torpid air was heavy with that smell.
Do you understand what I have said to you? She asked.
The witch doctor's wife closed her eyes.
I did not kill that boy.
I know, said Mara Motswe. It is never the women who do it, but that doesn't make any difference to the police. They have evidence against you, and the government wants to hang you too. Your husband first, you later. They do not like witchcraft, you know. They are ashamed. They think it's not modern.
But the boy is not dead,
blurted out the woman.
He is at the cattle post where my husband took him. He is working there. He is still alive.
Mara Motswe opened the door for the woman and slammed it shut behind her. Then she went round to the driver's door, opened it, and eased herself into the seat. The sun had made it burning hot, hot enough to scorch through the cloth of her dress, but pain did not matter now. All that mattered was to make the journey, which the woman said would take 4 hours. It was now 1 o'clock. They would be there just before sunset, and they could start the journey back immediately. If they had to stop overnight because the track was too bad, well, they could sleep in the back of the van. The important thing was to get to the boy. The journey was made in silence. The other woman tried to talk, but Mara Motswe ignored her. There was nothing she could say to this woman, nothing she wanted to say to her.
You are not a kind woman,
said the witch doctor's wife finally.
You are not talking to me. I am trying to talk to you, but you ignore me. You think that you are better than me, don't you?
Mara Motswe half turned to her.
The only reason why you are showing me where this boy is because you are afraid. You are not doing it because you want him to go back to his parents. You do not care about that, do you? You are a wicked woman, and I am warning you that if the police hear that you and your husband practice any more witchcraft, they will come and take you to prison. And if they don't, I have friends in Habrone who will come and do it for them. Do you understand what I am saying?
The hours passed. It was a difficult journey, out across open veldt, on the barest of tracks, until there, in the distance, they saw cattle stockades and the cluster of trees around a couple of huts.
"This is the cattle post," said the woman. "There are two Barsarwa there, a man and a woman, and the boy who has been working for them."
"How did you keep him?" asked Mara Motswe. "How did you know that he would not run away?"
"Look around you," said the woman. "You see how lonely this place is. The Basarwa would catch him before he could get far."
Something else occurred to Mara Motswe. The bone. If the boy was still alive, then where did the bone come from?
"There is a man in Caprone who bought a bone from your husband," she said. "Where did you get that?"
The woman looked at her scornfully.
"You can buy bones in Johannesburg. Did you not know that? They are not expensive."
The Basarwa were eating a rough porridge seated on two stones outside one of the huts. They were tiny, wizened people with the wide eyes of the hunter, and they stared at the intruders. Then the man rose to his feet and saluted the witch doctor's wife.
"Are the kettle all right?"
she asked sharply. The man made a strange clicking noise with his tongue.
"All right. They are not dead. That cow there is making much milk."
The words were Setswana words, but one had to strain to understand them. This was a man who spoke in the clicks and whistles of the Kalahari.
"Where is the boy?"
snapped the woman.
"That side," replied the man. "Look."
And then they saw the boy, standing beside a bush, watching them uncertainly. A dusty little boy in torn pants with a stick in his hand.
"Come here,"
called the witch doctor's wife.
"Come here."
The boy walked over to them, his eyes fixed on the ground in front of him. He had a scar on his forearm, a thick weal, and Mara Motswe knew immediately what had caused it. That was the cut of a whip, a shambok. She reached forward and laid a hand on his shoulder.
"What is your name?" she asked gently. "Are you the teacher's son from Katsana village?"
The boy shivered, but he saw the concern in her eyes and he spoke.
"I am that boy. I am working here now. These people are making me look after the cattle."
"And did this man strike you?" whispered Mara Motswe. "Did he?"
"All the time," said the boy. "He said that if I ran away, he would find me in the bush and put a sharpened stick through me."
"You are safe now," said Mara Motswe. "You are coming with me right now. Just walk in front of me. I will look after you."
The boy glanced at the Basarwa and began to move towards the van.
"Go on," said Mara Motswe. "I am coming too."
She put him in the passenger seat and closed the door. The witch doctor's wife called out,
"Wait a few minutes. I want to talk to these people about the kettle. Then we can go."
Mara Motswe moved round to the driver's door and let herself in.
"Wait,"
called the woman.
"I'm not going to be long."
Mara Motswe leaned forward and started the engine. Then, slipping the van into gear, she spun the wheel and pressed her foot on the accelerator. The woman shouted out and began to run after the van, but the dust cloud soon obscured her, and she tripped and fell. Mara Motswe turned to the boy, who was looking frightened and confused beside her.
"I am taking you home now," she said. "It will be a long journey, and I think we shall have to stop for the night quite soon. But we will set off again in the morning, and then it should not be too long."
She stopped the van an hour later, beside a dry riverbed. They were completely alone, with not even a fire from a remote cattle post to break the darkness of the night. Only the starlight fell on them, an attenuated silver light falling on the sleeping figure of the boy, wrapped in a sack, which she had in the back of the van, his head upon her arm, his breathing regular, his hand resting gently in hers, and Mara Motswe herself, whose eyes were open, looking up into the night sky until the sheer immensity of it tipped her gently into sleep. At Katsana village the next day, the schoolmaster looked out of the window of his house and saw a small white van draw up outside. He saw the woman get out and look at his door. And the child? What about the child? Was she a parent who was bringing her child to him for some reason? He went outside and found her at the low wall of his yard.
You are the teacher, Ra?
I am the teacher, Ma. Can I do anything for you?
She turned to the van and signaled to the child within. The door opened, and his son came out. And the teacher cried out and ran forward and stopped and looked at Ma Ramotswe as if for confirmation. She nodded, and he ran forward again, almost stumbling, an unlaced shoe coming off, to seize his son and hold him, while he shouted wildly, incoherently, for the village and the world to hear his joy. Ma Ramotswe walked back towards her van, not wanting to intrude upon the intimate moments of reunion. She was crying, for her own child too, remembering the minute hand that had grasped her own so briefly, while it tried to hold on to a strange world that was slipping away so quickly. There was so much suffering in Africa that it was tempting just to shrug your shoulders and walk away. But you can't do that, she thought. You just can't. Even a vehicle as reliable as the little white van, which did mile after mile without complaint, could find the dust too much. The tiny white van had been uncomplaining on the trip out to the cattle post, but now, back in town, it was beginning to stutter. It was the dust, she was sure of it. She telephoned Clock Weng Road Speedy Motors, not intending to bother Mr. J.L.B. Matekoni, but the receptionist was out to lunch, and he answered. She need not worry, he said. He would come round to look at the little white van the following day, a Saturday, and he might be able to fix it there on the spot, in Zebra Drive.
I doubt it, said Ma Ramotswe. It is an old van. It is like an old cow, and I will have to sell it, I suppose.
You won't, said Mr. J. L. B. Matekoni.
Anything can be fixed. Anything.
Even a heart that is broken in two pieces, he thought. Can they fix that? Could Professor Barnard, down in Cape Town, cure a man whose heart was bleeding from loneliness? Ma Ramotswe went shopping that morning. Her Saturday mornings had always been important to her. She went to the supermarket in the mall and bought her groceries and her vegetables from the women on the pavement outside the chemist's. After that, she went to the President Hotel and drank coffee with her friends, then home and half a glass of Lion beer, taken sitting out on the veranda and reading the newspaper. As a private detective, it was important to scour the newspaper and to put the facts away in one's mind. All of it was useful, down to the last line of the politicians' predictable speeches and the church notices. You never knew when some snippet of local knowledge would come in useful. If you asked Ma Ramotswe to give, for instance, the names of convicted diamond smugglers, she could give them to you. Archie Mofobe, Pix Ngube, Molso Mobole, and George Excellence Tambe. She had read the reports of the trials of them all and knew their sentences. 6 years, 6 years, 10 years, and 8 months. It had all been reported and filed away. And who owned the Wait No More butchery in Old Naledi? Why, Godfrey Potowani, of course. She remembered the photograph in the newspaper of Godfrey standing in front of his new butchery with the Minister of Agriculture. And why was the minister there? Because his wife, Modella, was the cousin of one of the Potowane women who had made that dreadful fuss at the wedding of Stokes Lofinale. That's why. Ma Ramotswe could not understand people who took no interest in all this. How could one live in a town like this and not want to know everybody's business, even if one had no professional reason for doing so? He arrived shortly after 4, driving up in his blue garage baki with Clock Weng Road Speedy Motors painted on the side. He was wearing his mechanic's overalls, which were spotlessly clean and ironed neatly down the creases. She showed him the tiny white van parked beside the house, and he wheeled out a large jack from the back of his truck. "I'll make you a cup of tea," she said. "You can drink it while you look at the van." From the window she watched him. She saw him open the engine compartment and tap at bits and pieces. She saw him climb into the driver's cab and start the motor, which coughed and spluttered and eventually died out. She watched as he removed something from the engine, a large part, from which wires and hoses protruded. That was the heart of the van, perhaps. Its loyal heart, which had beaten so regularly and reliably, but which, ripped out, now looked so vulnerable. Mr. J. L. B. Matekoni moved backwards and forwards between his truck and the van. Two cups of tea were taken out, and then a third, as it was a hot afternoon. Then Mara Motswe went into her kitchen and put vegetables into a pot and watered the plants that stood on the back windowsill. Dusk was approaching, and the sky was streaked with gold. This was her favourite time of the day, when the birds went dipping and swooping through the air, and the insects of the night started to shriek. In this gentle light, the cattle would be walking home, and the fires outside the huts would be crackling and glowing for the evening's cooking. She went out to see whether Mr. J. L. B. Matekoni needed more light. He was standing beside the little white van, wiping his hands on lint.
"That should be fine now," he said. "I've tuned it up, and the engine ran sweetly, like a bee."
She clapped her hands in pleasure.
"I thought that you would have to scrap it," she said.
He laughed.
"I told you anything could be fixed, even an old van."
He followed her inside. She poured him a beer, and they went together to her favourite place to sit, on the veranda near the bougainvillea. Not far away, in a neighbouring house, music was being played, the insistent traditional rhythms of township music. The sun went, and it was dark. He sat beside her in the comfortable darkness, and they listened contentedly to the sounds of Africa settling down for the night. A dog barked somewhere. A car engine raced and then died away. There was a touch of wind, warm, dusty wind, redolent of thorn trees. He looked at her in the darkness, at this woman who was everything to him. Mother, Africa, wisdom, understanding, good things to eat, pumpkins, chicken, the smell of sweet cattle breath, the white sky across the endless, endless bush, and the giraffe that cried, giving its tears for women to daub on their baskets. "Oh, Botswana, my country, my place." Those were his thoughts. But how could he say any of that to her? Any time he tried to tell her what was in his heart, the words which came to him seemed so inadequate. A mechanic cannot be a poet, he thought. That is not how things are. So he simply said,
"I am very happy that I fixed your van for you. I would have been sorry if somebody else had lied to you and said it was not worth fixing. There are people like that in the motor trade."
"I know," said Mara Motswe, "but you are not like that."
He said nothing. There were times when you simply had to speak, or you would have your lifetime ahead to regret not speaking. But every time he had tried to speak to her of what was in his heart, he had failed. He had already asked her to marry him, and that had not been a great success. He did not have a great deal of confidence, at least with people. Cars were different, of course.
"I am very happy sitting here with you."
She turned to him.
"What did you say?"
"I said, please marry me, Mara Motswe. I am just Mr. J. L. B. Matekoni, that's all. But please marry me and make me happy."
"Of course I will," said Mara Motswe.
The number one ladies' detective agency, written by Alexander McCall Smith and read by Ajua Ando.
Africa, yeah, Africa, yeah, yeah, Africa, Africa, yeah, Africa, 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 yeah.